All right, so tonight we're going to be looking at chapters 50 and 51. This is the judgment against Babylon. So I've been alluding to this for several weeks now, where as the Lord called Babylon his servant, he is going to dispense his judgment against them for their folly and for their lack of obedience to him. And because they, although they were the executioner of God's judgment against his people, they also were terribly evil towards his people. And so he is going to execute judgment against them. And again, as we mentioned before, chapters 45 through 51 all have a timestamp from chapter 45. So if we look at the chronology, we'll see that 45 through 51 fall in this reign of Jehoiakim in the year 604 BC. And a couple of verses out of chapter 49 and a couple of verses out of chapter 51 tonight have a different timestamp. And we'll point those out when we get to them. But the point being here that the timestamp we're given for these lets us know that this is definitely a prophecy. This is not something that happened days before. This was Jeremiah receiving word that this was going to happen a long, long time before it would, because we're going to see as we get further into the study tonight that the prophecy against Babylon isn't carried out until after God sees fit to carry it out. And that's at the end of the 70 years that he told Jerusalem and Jeremiah, and Jeremiah told Jerusalem and Judah that they would be in captivity for those 70 years that they earned in captivity due to their absolute flat disobedience of God. So starting in chapter 50, we pick right up the word which the Lord spoke concerning Babylon, the land of the Chaldeans, through Jeremiah the prophet. And we're going to learn that a nation from the north will make Babylon desolate. So from which direction would the nation come that would make Babylon desolate?
North?
Yeah, exactly. I made it easy for you. From the north. So what we got here is a map in the year 540 BC. This is 4 years before the Medes and Persians take over Babylon. So you can see that Persia is already, by this time, this is towards the end of the captivity of the Jews. They will start being released in the year 536 BC, and that release will continue through several decades. Until the building of the wall of Jerusalem is complete. But you can see that the Persian Empire in the year 540 BC dwarfs the Babylonian Empire. The Persian Empire has already engulfed much of what Babylon had. And if we look at the next map, this is the Persian Empire after they take over Babylon. And so we can see that this Persian Empire is huge. And we can understand why this empire, which stretched all the way from northern Africa and Egypt into Turkey and over into parts of Greece, and then as far east as Iraq and some of those other Middle Eastern countries that are not thought of, or Iran, I mean, that are not thought of very much. But this huge empire, which was conquering everything, but had a different take on how they would control the people in their empire. They weren't so much worried about taking them into captivity as they were about just putting them under the rule of the Persian king and making them pay tribute. So, this army out of the north is going to make Babylon desolate. And they certainly did. If you were looking at the title slide I showed you tonight, the site of Babylon is still a mess. It's just desolate. There's nothing there. Saddam Hussein spent time and money and many lives trying to rebuild on that area of Babylon. And there are some developed things in that area, but there is not much there. It's still a very desolate place. And it is a place of ruin, as the Lord said it would be. So in verse 4, in those days and at that time, Israel and Judah together will ask the way to Zion. And what did the Lord say would happen in those days and that time?
The sons of Judah will be well and will seek their God, and they will ask which way to Zion, and they will join in an everlasting covenant.
And that's the important part there that I'm getting at. They're going to kind of join themselves to Yahweh in an everlasting covenant that will not be forgotten. So we have reference to them coming back to the Lord. And this covenant that they speak of, that is spoken of here, is important for us to put into perspective. The covenant that they are going to join themselves into is going to be a new covenant. The old covenant that they had with the Lord, they had violated. And because they violated that covenant, God gave them to their enemies. They spent 70 years in captivity. Now, that old covenant was still in place, and it would be for several hundred more years. But there's a new covenant coming, and this may be a first look. We've had some allusions to Christ and to the coming of the new covenant. I don't necessarily say that's what this is here. This is the people coming back to God, coming back to him and joining him in that covenant. But when we look at it, it's called an everlasting covenant that will not be forgotten. Well, in God's mind, that original covenant had a purpose. It was an everlasting covenant to God. He would have maintained that covenant had the people maintained the covenant. But the people continuously violated the covenant. They violated it time and time again. And once they come back out of captivity, they'll be under that old covenant again. And they will strive to do their best to keep the covenant. But we're going to see that as we come into the New Testament, especially into the Gospels, that they had lost their way, that they weren't keeping that old covenant. Jesus points that out to the Pharisees time and time again, that they were violating the old covenant in almost everything they were doing in the name of God. He points out that they tie their dill and mint, but forget the weightier matters of the law. And it's because of their continuous violation of that covenant that God considered everlasting, but that the people violated and destroyed, that a new covenant will be established. The old covenant won't be forgotten. It served a purpose. And as we've studied many times before, the old covenant was a tutor to guide the people to the new covenant that would be an eternal covenant between Jesus and the Lord and all of us, both from creation until the end. Yes.
And in Hebrews 8, it outlines that better covenant.
Right.
Right.
Correct. Yeah, we have discussion of that covenant all throughout the New Testament. But again, what I say here is there's allusion to that here, but I don't think that he's specifically talking about the new covenant yet. I think he's still talking about the people coming back into a covenant relationship with the Lord because they had broken that covenant relationship with the Lord in a matter so heinous that the Lord had to give them up for 70 years into captivity. Now, that didn't mean the Lord didn't take care of them. He promised he would. But they had violated that covenant in such a heinous way that they had to be punished. So nations are called upon to go up against Babylon. And how was vengeance to be taken against Babylon?
Can I just make a comment about this notion that it's an everlasting covenant?
Yeah, go ahead.
I like your point that they were coming. They were not coming back to the New Testament. They were coming back to the Old Testament. And a lot of prophecies are this way. You find an immediate fulfillment and then a longer term fulfillment. And the immediate fulfillment may not look just like the longer term fulfillment, but they demonstrate something that's kind of the same. The people had to repent and turn back to God to get the new covenant, the New Testament.
Yes, and that's, we see that in many prophecies that we look at, and we've looked at them in Jeremiah. When you look at them in Isaiah, many of those prophecies had a meaning for the people that was near and dear to them. That was a prophecy that was going to be fulfilled to them. But also many of those prophecies also had meaning many, many, many centuries later. We look at many of the prophecies of David and how he was tortured or persecuted in a way that was that he pleaded to God for help. But many of those Psalms of David definitely and most obviously refer to Christ. And so it had a meaning to David at that time that the people could understand, but it also had a meaning to us in the time of Christ. And that's something we can take away from, I think, from the things we read about with these covenants, that for those people, it had a meaning then. For us, it also has a meaning. And an allusion to a new and better covenant, one in which there wasn't just a passing over of sins, but a forgiveness of sin. So again, how was vengeance to be taken against Babylon?
The vengeance of the Lord.
Right. Yeah, and he's pretty specific about what's going to happen to you. Yeah, I think if we look at, let me get my windows out of, I'm going to have to move some windows around. I got my screen all full here so I can get to some of the points I'm trying to make. So if we look down at, Verse nine, I think. Go ahead, Richard.
Oh, I was just going to say, due to her as she has done, but.
Yeah. If we look down at verse 9, for behold, I am going to arouse and bring up against Babylon a horde of great nations from the land of the north, and they will draw up their battle lines against her, for she will be taken captive. Their arrows will be like an expert warrior who does not return empty handed. Chaldea will become plunder. All who plunder her will have enough. If we drop down to verse 13, because of the indignation of the Lord, she will not be inhabited, but she will be completely desolate. Everyone who passes by Babylon will be horrified and will hiss because of all of her wounds. And if we drop down a little further into verse 15, raise your battle cry against her on every side. She is given herself up, her pillars have fallen, her walls have been torn down, for this is the vengeance of the Lord. Take vengeance on her as she has done to others, so do to her. So we see that Babylon is going to pay the price for how they had treated so many of their captives, for the heinous activities they had performed against other people in that they had taken captive. not only just the slaughter of people, but the absolute torture of their captives. And that's what we see that the Lord is referring to, is she is going to be desolate. And as she has done to others, the Lord is telling this nation to the north, these many nations to the north, so do to her. They want her. The Lord is giving Persia the permission to completely annihilate Babylon so that she is never occupied again. So he goes on to say, Babylon has been found and caught by the Lord. Why had Babylon been found and caught? What did Babylon do specifically that irked the Lord greatly?
Well, he says, Ted, in verse 24, they've striven against the Lord. They did not do what God had instructed them to do.
Exactly. And we had seen some of that last week, that some of the ways that Babylon had treated some of the other nations, they did not do exactly what the Lord told them to do. And it was going to come back to haunt them. He had given them specific instructions about what he wanted done. And they did not always follow through with that. And in verse 24, that's specifically where I went with it. I set a snare for you and you were caught, Babylon, while you yourself were not aware. It says, you have been found also. You have been found and also seized because you have engaged in conflict with the Lord, or you have striven with the Lord. He says, I set a snare for you. And Yahweh opened his armory and brought forth weapons of his indignation. And then Yahweh works himself against the land of the Chaldeans. It is, as we read in the New Testament, a fearful thing to come into the hands of the Lord, or to come before the wrath of the Lord. And you can imagine Nebuchadnezzar's grandson seeing a hand writing on the wall, not knowing what the words meant, brought some fear to him, even in his drunken stupor of a party that he was having. You can imagine that would actually focus your mind like a laser beam, because there is something wrong when you see a hand writing on a wall, carving in stone. That's going to get your attention. And the Babylonians are going to learn the hard way, almost instantly, that you do not strive against the Lord.
In verse 31, he calls them arrogant.
Yeah, exactly. And we had talked about that last week too, about the arrogance of the nations around Judah, and again, the arrogance of Babylon. They were arrogant, and the Lord tells them, your day has come. The time when I will punish you. And he is laying down specifics of what that's going to look like. And it doesn't look good for Babylon. It looks pretty scary, if you ask me. So Yahweh is going to plead his case for Israel and against her captors. So what two things would be accomplished when Yahweh pleads his case against the oppressors of Israel and Judah?
He wanted to keep the peace on earth and also stir up the inhabitants of Babylon.
Exactly. So he's bringing rest to the earth. He's going to put in charge a different nation, a nation that is going to bring peace, whether that be through subduing the other nations or conquering the other nations. But what we're seeing go into place here with the Medes and the Persians, who will then be followed by the Greeks, who will then be followed by the Romans, is superpower. a superpower for that entire area of the planet, where that superpower is in complete control. Israel will never be in control of their own nation ever again. They will never have what they had under David or Solomon. They will always be under the thumb of another nation. But what we see is these nations rising after Babylon have an agenda, and that is to turn the world as they know it into them. So the reason the Persians aren't treating the other nations they have taken around them like Babylon did, taking them into slavery and captivity, was because to Persia, everything that they conquered was theirs. So Israel is Persia's. Edom is Persia's. Egypt is Persia's. Turkey is Persia's. Syria is Persia's. Babylon is Persia's. Everything was theirs. And so they would be under complete control. And that's one way in which the Lord was going to bring rest to the earth, is there wouldn't be all this bickering, all this fighting, and there wouldn't be all this torture that's required. Persia's main goal was to completely control everything. And the countries that would rise up after the Medes and the Persians would work in a similar way. They were going to rule with an iron fist. And that meant that no matter where they went, they were going to control that area. And then the Lord also says he'll bring turmoil to the inhabitants of Babylon. And he did that. When Cyrus came into Babylon, he utterly annihilated the Babylon and killed the king. Left no guessing about who was in control. And the Lord told them that that was going to happen. And he told them 90 years before it happened. Babylon didn't listen. So Babylon is going to be desolate because of this army from the north. What will happen at the noise of the taking of Babylon?
The earth is shaken and the outcry is heard among the nations.
Exactly. So this isn't going to be something that's done, you know, I hate to say that it's not going to be something that's done in the middle of the night, but that's exactly what it was. When Cyrus came in, Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, I don't remember that specific king's name. It's a Bel something. But told him that this is what this means. The writing on the wall means this. And not only that, it's going to happen tonight. Tonight, you will lose your life and you will lose your throne. And that's exactly what happened. The Persia conquered Babylon then and there. It was swift and it was just. And a cry will be heard among the nations. That cry was Babylon giving up the ghost. They were done. They were no longer a power to be reckoned with. They were no longer a country to fear because the Lord had given them to the Persians.
Ed?
Yes, Ralph.
That was Belteshazzar you were thinking of.
I was thinking Belteshazzar, but what was Daniel's name? I forgot what I thought
Belshazzar.
Okay, so Nebuchadnezzar's grandson was Belteshazzar.
Belteshazzar, if I remember correctly. And what they did, they diverted the river that flowed under the walls of Babylon. Now they marched in on under the wall in the dried up riverbed and kept Babylon that night.
Yep. Yeah, it was swift and just, and there was no doubt about what was going on. And Babylon wasn't in any position to stop them because they were all drunk. They were partying. They were by no means ready for a battle against the Persians. And they took them, the Persians took them by surprise and completely destroyed Babylon.
Ed, it's
the king to death.
It's called a defeat without a shot being fired.
Yep, it was quick and I would say painless, but probably not. So Babylon was the Lord's cup, but now she has fallen. So to where did the judgment of Babylon reach?
To the heaven and towers up to the very skies.
Exactly. This was the Lord's judgment against his chosen arm to bring punishment to the Jews and the Gentiles. It was the Lord's choice that Babylon would bring judgment. But because of Babylon's disobedience, it was also the Lord's choice that Babylon would be judged by him. And Babylon would be judged by who he chose to be the justice of the time, and that was Cyrus. That's also who the Lord chose to bring justice to his people, because Cyrus allowed the Jews to go home. So the spirit of the Medes has been raised up against Babylon, and whom had the Lord raised up for his plan against Babylon?
The kings of the Medes.
Exactly. And when we talk about the kings of the Medes, I did a lot of research looking at these different kings and the lineage and the lines, and it gets really confusing looking at some of that stuff, trying to figure out who was in charge and trying to figure out who was Cyrus versus who was Darius versus there were more than one Cyrus and there was more than one Darius. So it's really hard to keep straight who was who when you read about them in the Bible, as far as who was in charge for the Medes and the Persians at specific times. But if you look at Daniel in chapter 5 and verses 24 through 31, this is the story where Daniel is called in to read this inscription. And it started in verse 24 of Daniel chapter 5. It says, "Then the hand was sent from him, and this inscription was written out." Now, this inscription was the one that was written out, "Many, many tekel upharshin." This is the interpretation of the message. "Many, God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found deficient. And Perez, the kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and the Persians." Then Belshazzar, that's the king. Belteshazzar was Daniel's name. So Belshazzar gave orders, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a necklace, a gold necklace around his neck, and issued a proclamation concerning him that he now had authority as the third ruler in the kingdom. That same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62.
He said Belshazzar. And
Belteshazzar is Daniel's name,
yeah,
and Belshazzar is the king's name. Yeah, yeah. So we see right here, the Lord had raised up this King Darius and King Cyrus. It was Darius the Mede who received the kingdom, and it was Cyrus who would reign shortly thereafter. That would be the king who would release the Jews. And the chronology of it is kind of muddled. It looks kind of like Darius was the first king and then Cyrus was after him, but they may have had some overlap there where one king was ruling one part and another king was ruling another part. It's really hard. Sometimes you see dates that show that they were 8 years apart, and sometimes you see dates that show that the two kings were ruling at the same time. So it's really hard to tell, except that we have to take this we have to take it at its word that Darius was the person who did this. And the historical record does point out that Darius was the one who came in and conquered Babylon. So I've got a little bit of information about the kings that I just wanted to just step to the side here just for a minute and talk about it. So Cyrus II, also known as Cyrus the Great, ruled from 576 to 530. So Babylon fell in 536. Darius I, also known as Darius the Great, ruled from 550 to 486. So like I said, there's some overlap there. It's kind of difficult to figure it out. That's because the Medes and the Persians were kind of one nation, but kind of two. You had two separate dynasties that were kind of going back and forth trying to be the ruler. And so I got a little story for you here. I thought it was interesting. It kind of brings into perspective what we're talking about. So Cyrus II and Darius I were both part of the Achaemenid family dynasty. Darius was the second cousin once removed of Cyrus II. And Cyrus's great-grandfather, Tespis, was Darius's great-great-grandfather. Darius was also Cyrus's son-in-law as he married his daughter, Atossa. So there's all sorts of mingling going on there. You can see that the interrelations are all weaved together. There's another Darius mentioned in Daniel chapter 5 and verse 31, chapter 6 verses 1 through 28, chapter 9 verse 1, and chapter 11 and verse 1. He is known as Darius the Mede to distinguish him from the later King Darius the First. We are told that he is about 62 years old when he became king over Babylon in Daniel chapter 5 and verse 32. There are no other historical records of this Darius. Possibly he was the same person as Gobryas, a general of Cyrus II, who helped conquer Babylon, according to Xenophon. And so terribly interesting read if you want to read about the Medes and the Persians. One of the stories is that there were six of these royalty type folks who were trying to decide what they wanted to do with Persia. One of them wanted to make it a republic, like a democracy. One of them wanted to make it I can't remember what the second one wanted, but the Cyrus wanted it to be a monarchy. And so the six of them debated among themselves and tried to figure out which direction they were going to go with the kingdom. And they came up with a way to make that happen. It was going to be decided that whoever was going to be the royalty, the person in charge, the six of them would get on their horses at dawn and stand and wait for the sun to come up. And the first king's horse who neighed at the sun would be declared the ruler. Well, Cyrus cheated. And he didn't actually cheat. It was his horseman who cheated. His horseman had a mare who Cyrus's horse was very interested in. And so he got the scent of that horse and put his hand up next to the horse's nostrils when the sun came up so that the horse would neigh. So Cyrus, the horse neighed first before the other horses, and all the other satraps got down off of their horses, bowed down to Cyrus, and he was the king. So you can see there's some really interesting stories about the Persian Empire that aren't told us in the Bible. Those are historical records that have been unearthed in archaeological finds and such, but very interesting, I thought, to know that the lineage of all of these kings is kind of well known, but the inner workings between these kings is also fluid because they were related to each other and intermarried. And so you can see that it was really hard to keep track of some of that stuff, but it's very interesting. And we see that Daniel tells us that Darius was responsible. Darius the Mede was responsible for leading and taking Babylon that night. Moving on after that sidestep, Yahweh is the maker of all things. And so what has the Lord made by what? Has the Lord made the earth and established the world?
His wisdom and his understanding.
Power, wisdom, and understanding. Yes. And in chapter 51 and verse 15, it is he, the Lord, who made the earth by his power, who established the world by his wisdom, and by his understanding, he stretched out the heavens. When he utters his voice, there is a tumult of waters in the heavens, and he causes the clouds to ascend from the end of the earth. He makes lightning for the rain and brings the wind from his storehouses. All mankind is stupid, devoid of knowledge. Every goldsmith is put to shame by his idols, for his molten images are deceitful, and there is no breath in them. They are worthless, a work of mockery. In the time of their punishment, they will perish. The portion of Jacob is not like these, for the maker of all is he, and of the tribe of his inheritance, the Lord of hosts is his name. I think it's interesting that as we're talking about the destruction of Babylon and the punishment they're going to go through, the Lord is not afraid to show that he is in control, that he is the all-powerful God. He is in control of all of this, and it is by his will that it happens. So Babylon's going to pay for their ways. Why was the Lord against Babylon?
For the evil they had done in Zion.
Exactly. For the evil they had done in Zion, and they would be desolate forever. So the Lord is treating Babylon the way he treated several of the countries who had been thorns in the side of Israel. And he's going to allow Babylon to be completely annihilated, wiped out forever. There would be no trace of them. They will be, whoever survives this takeover of Babylon, which we know the Jews do, and many of the other countries that were taken captive by the Babylonians, they survive as well. But those Chaldeans were utterly destroyed, annihilated, wiped off the face of the earth by the Lord and by the power he had given to the Medes and the Persians. And the blood of Zion is on the head of Babylon. What would the Lord punish in Babylon specifically?
Well, it says he would punish Bel, and Bel is the chief Babylonian deity.
Governors and rulers?
Uh-oh. Where did Ted go?
I think you lost him.
I think Ted's connection failed. So this notion that God was going to punish Bel is very similar to the notion that you saw when God led the children of Israel out of Egypt. The plagues were an affront and really signaled a punishment that was brought by God on the gods of Egypt. That for them, there was the God of the Nile. And so God turned the Nile into blood. It was a direct assault on what they perceived their gods to be. Any other thoughts? So is the question is there anything that Babylon can do to prevent this from happening?
God has made it clear that in his making statements about the future that Babylon is condemned. And Bel or Marduk, Merodach, I think is Israeli, you know, Jewish version of Bel or Marduk. It's going to be completely destroyed, and the city is, the Babylon is going to eventually, just disappear. It's kind of interesting about Babylon because, the Euphrates River used to flow through the city, and now it's 50 miles south of where the river is. So the river changed direction, and Babylon just eventually just completely disappeared. Yeah. Just as the Lord said it would.
And I think it's important to understand there's two kinds of prophecy, remember, from our study in understanding the prophets. There's the call to repentance, and then there's God expressing what's just going to happen. This is the plan that God has had all along. The Babylonians are going to come to power, then the Medo-Persian Empire, then the Greeks, then the Romans. And there's nothing that anybody can do to stop that. It's this punishment that came on the Babylonians came because of their wickedness, but there was no repentance that they could offer. And there was no way they could fortify their city against it. If you go down to verse 33, what could Babylon have possibly done to prevent this destruction?
It could have originally done what God asked them to do.
True. But at this point, they can't fortify. There aren't enough fortifications to prevent this from happening. In verse 33, though Babylon should mount up to the heaven, though she should fortify the height of her strength, yet from me, because I am Jehovah, shall the spoilers come unto her, saith the Lord. And it's because I am me, and no matter what you do, you are not going to stand against God.
You know, Dean, I can pick up. I just need you to make me a co-host so I can share my screen again.
Oh, okay. Let me find you here. Hold on.
Sorry, guys. My laptop battery died. I didn't even know it was getting low. And when it died, I was done. Just everything went blank.
Okay, you're a co-host now.
Okay.
It's so nice to know that I'm not the only one that messes up technology.
Nope. And I was glad you guys had a great discussion. That sounded very interesting, and I I'm glad you guys got into that. This idea of who would the Lord punish, what I was trying to get to was the God of Babylon was going to pay the price. This God made by their hands was going to go away. Bel or Marduk, whatever his name was, these nations would no longer stream to him, and then he would be eventually forgotten. This God of the Babylonians, just like their country, was just going to fade into the past and just be an archaeological site. Also, the rulers of Babylon are going to sleep a perpetual sleep. So even if Babylon were to do what, yet plunderers would come to her. And this is what you guys were just talking about. Even if Babylon were to ascend to the heavens and fortify her lofty stronghold, the Lord would send destroyers for her. There is nothing that Babylon could do that was going to change the judgment that the Lord had against her. And again, remember, this judgment was made in 604 BC. She was going to fall in 536 BC. So Babylon had a long time to ruminate about this. Jeremiah, as we've seen, was never one who tried to keep these prophecies to himself. And we're going to see that the Lord did his very best to help Babylon make the right choice as we get into the end of this chapter. So these are the verses I was talking about where we're given more information about when this is happening. And so we're jumping ahead here in chapter 51, verses 59 through 64. We're now jumping into the reign of Zedekiah in the year 593. So, and you can see that we were chapters 46 through 51 are back up here in 604. We drop down here into the reign of Zedekiah now. Chapter 51, verses 59 through 64. We've dropped down, looks like about 11 years. So there, now you can see it. And so Jeremiah instructs Sariah to read a prophecy in Babylon. And after Sariah had read the prophecy against Babylon, what was he to do with it?
As soon as you finish reading this scroll, you will tie a stone to it and throw it into the middle of the Euphrates.
Exactly. And then he's to say, just so shall Babylon sink down and not rise again. Because of the calamity I am going to bring upon her, and they will become exhausted. They will be done. There will be nothing left of Babylon when I'm done with her. And that's the Lord's judgment against Babylon in 593. Again, that gives Babylon ample time to pay attention to the Lord. They've seen the power of the Lord. They're going to see the power of the Lord again because they ignore it. I fully suspect that Nebuchadnezzar understood the power of the Lord, but by the time his grandson rolls around, that had all been forgotten. Those things had gone away. And Belshazzar was living up life, doing what he wanted, having a great old time, partying, drinking, making merry, and the Lord had to interrupt that for him. And he interrupted it severely and in a fashion that Belshazzar, I'm sure, wasn't ready for. So some of the things we can take from this. In the defeat of Babylon, let us never forget that no matter how powerful a nation may become, its fate still lies in God's providence. And Babylon at the time was the power. We saw through the last 20 chapters that Babylon was the power. And Judah and Jerusalem were told time and time again, don't try to fight them.
They are my servant. Don't try to come up against them. Just surrender. They are my chosen power. And if you surrender, I will take care of you. But if you do not surrender, you will pay the price. At the time, Babylon was the power. But Babylon's fate still lies in God's hands. And we can remember that of these ancient nations. We can remember that of the great nation of Rome. And we can remember that about every nation that has come since. Nations come and nations go. Our fates all lie in God's providence. And when God chooses to be done because of disobedience, then God is done. And he will make it so. We may not see how it's going to happen. We may not understand how that's going to happen. But that doesn't mean that it's not going to. It's easy for us to get, I don't want to say us. It's easy for our nation, as it currently stands, to become arrogant because we're one of the superpowers on the planet. That doesn't mean anything to God. We are here because of his providence. We grew out of God's providence. We continue to thrive out of his providence. And when God is done, when he has reached the end of his patience, his providence will end. And it doesn't matter how powerful the nation is. That will be the end when God says it is. And throughout this prophecy against Babylon, there are references to the restoration of Israel. For instance, is the verses that are mentioned there, chapter 50, verses 4 and 5, 33 and 34, and chapter 51, verses 45 and 46. God always knows those who belong to him. And while it seems hopeless in this world among God's enemies, he knows all that is going on, and he will redeem. We don't have to worry about what's going to happen tomorrow. That's not our job. Our job is to worry about what is happening today. And Jesus tells us that in the New Testament. We don't need to worry about tomorrow. Sufficient are the worries of today for us. Let God take care of tomorrow. We do the best we can with what we have today. So we use our talents. We apply those as well as we can. And we do our best to make people know about God. But it's not our job and is not our worry to have. God doesn't want us worrying about what's going to happen tomorrow. Because that's what his job is to take care of tomorrow and all of the tomorrows. God will make sure that his people are taken care of. So even when it seems hopeless, and sometimes it can seem hopeless, especially in the last year and a half that we've been dealing with things getting worse and worse, and then the pandemic, and I just can't tell you how hard this has been on some people, seeing the mental health degradation of society around us is just amazing. But again, God knows who belongs to him and he will take care of those. So, God is in control. And I think if Jeremiah tells us nothing else, it's that we can depend on God to always be there when we need him, as long as we're striving for God and not against him. All right, let's open it back up. Are there any questions or comments?
Ted, as I was reading through the last couple of chapters, it really struck me that Nebuchadnezzar had always been pretty kindly disposed towards Jeremiah. Nebuchadnezzar, you know, you might think, well, Nebuchadnezzar's always been Jeremiah's friend, and so Jeremiah's going to be nice to Nebuchadnezzar, but he's not. Jeremiah is an equal opportunity punisher. No matter who you are, then you must listen to God. And I can't change the prophecy just because you've been nice to me.
Right. And, you know, Jeremiah had access to these, the knowledge of what would the future would look like as far as the prophecy that had been given to him. And he could see that choices were going to be made, which were not towards God, just as Israel had made choices that were not towards God. And we saw in the first 30 chapters of Jeremiah that really, really distressed Jeremiah, distressed him greatly about the poor choices that Judah was making, about the poor choices that the priests were making, that the king was making, that the princes were making. We see him as the weeping prophet because he was so distressed about the destruction and demise that was coming on his people. After seeing that, it's hard for me to believe that Jeremiah had much compassion for Babylon, the country that utterly wiped out Jerusalem and the temple. We saw Jeremiah, we read several times where his compassion was stretched thin, where Jeremiah had a really hard time coping with what he was seeing happening around him. He just didn't, it was hard for him to deal with all of the calamity that was coming upon them and knowing that this was the Lord's will and that there was nothing that they could do about it because they were unwilling to soften their hearts. We saw time and time again that the Lord said, if you will not harden your heart towards me, we can avoid these things. We can avoid this calamity. We saw how the Lord granted that to Josiah. Josiah softened his heart towards the Lord when the law was read. He did his very best to turn the country around, to turn their hearts towards God. But yet the country still went downhill. And I think we can take a lot from Jeremiah, from what we've read over these last 23 weeks now, about how important it is to just not get depressed about what's going on around us. Because we need to remember that God is always in control. And regardless of what happens, God is going to look out for his and his own. And as bad as it may get, we can take comfort in that, knowing that God is in control. Any other comments or questions? All right, guys. So next week we'll be looking at chapter 52. It's kind of a review chapter of Jeremiah. We'll be spending a little bit of time in that, and it may take most of the hour. We'll see. But I will fill it with, if chapter 52 doesn't completely fill it, we'll probably use chapter 52 to refer back to some of our other studies, because chapter 52 is a good kind of review chapter for the book of Jeremiah. And then next week will be our last study in Jeremiah. It's been, I've enjoyed it immensely. I hope it's been instructive for all of you. It's been very instructive for me, I can say that. There's a lot to learn from Jeremiah about our current times. Not that Jeremiah is talking at all specifically about that, but that we can see from the errors made in the past, the repeat of errors being made in the present. And it's knowledge that we can apply, wisdom we can use to help people around us understand that living a lifestyle that's outside of what God has said is righteous just isn't acceptable. And the Lord is patient, but he's not infinitely patient, and he has his limits as well. If there are no other comments or questions, then we'll have Charlie lead us in a closing prayer.